You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
Welcome once again to Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. This is me, Robin Kerner, and I am very pleased to be back in Seattle recording this show. Some of you may know I have been out of the country, out of the continent for the best part of a month. I was in the UK and to Georgia. Georgia, the country, not the state, where I was doing some work with the Georgian Students for Liberty. Yes, there is such a thing, and that was fantastic. And whilst I was in the UK, I got involved with the UKIP meeting, and that was very interesting and inspired me to write my article that came out today, What UKIP Must Learn from the American Liberty Movement. So if you're interested in that, what the cousins across the pond are doing for liberty, check that out, Huffington Post, Daily Paul, all the normal places. So yes, forgive me in advance, please, everyone. I am deliriously jet-lagged. That flight back from Tbilisi, Georgia, was 29 hours, and I had 11 time zones I crossed, and I think it might take me as many days to recover, so I'm struggling. So if I black out, that's my excuse. But I have been looking forward to this show since pretty much the time I left. The largest audience figures that Blue Republican Radio has had so far, and we're a new show, but the biggest audience figures we had was when I interviewed the awesome Jeffrey Tucker. That would have been about a month ago now, I think, and when that aired. And we kind of finished that interview, he and I, excited about the possibility of continuing on some of the themes that we discussed. I think it's fair to say, and I will invite Jeffrey to disagree with me if I'm wrong, that he and I see much of what we need to do in the Liberty Movement in the same way. So I am delighted to say he is back here to carry on where we left off last time a month ago. Jeffrey, welcome back and thank you.
It's a pleasure, Robin. Thank you so much. You know, it's interesting that you say that we see things a similar way, because I'm not sure if I'm right about this, but I tend to think of you as more of a more traditional classical liberal, and I am an anarchist.
Yes.
However, I don't really see these views, and I hope you agree with me, as antagonistic. I think the difference is a matter of application, and probably you're not entirely convinced of the viability of a stateless society where I am.
Right.
And that probably sort of defines the differences. But the spirit of the views I represent, which just imagine that the core order of society sort of grows out of our associations with each other, that perspective is rooted and the history of liberalism itself. I don't see it as a radical departure, but a kind of an organic and gradual outgrowth of that tradition. And I don't think it should be severed, if you know what I mean.
Mm, absolutely. Well, I mean, I agree, obviously, with everything you said there. And the reason I said I think that we see what we need to be doing in the Liberty Movement in the same way is because underlying, perhaps, are different political positions, my classical liberalism versus, if you like, versus your anarchism. We have the same concerns about how to approach our philosophy, how to
sure.
come to a good philosophy, and what indeed a good and effective philosophy is. And epistemologically, then, I think perhaps we're cut from the same cloth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. You know, and it's interesting for me to read in the history of classical liberalism and see the themes that sort of animate my perspective on the world. I mean, what was the key insight of liberalism as it grew up in the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance and the Enlightenment? To me, the theme is that there's a sort of self-ordering dynamic to society, that order is not simply imposed by, you know, a Leviathan, but rather sort of extends out of our associations and trade, and that, well, that's the expression laissez-faire, right? I mean, if you let it alone, then everything will work itself out for the common good. I think that is a good way of summarizing the essential liberal insight.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you ended the show last time raising a question that sounded a little kind of over dramatic, but then you pointed out that it certainly wasn't, that it was actually a question that, as a practical matter, we need to answer, which is, do we in the Liberty Movement want to improve society or destroy it? And this came out of an hour of discussing I would certainly say self-falsifying brutalist approach to libertarianism that you so eloquently conveyed in both the interview that we did and that article that prompted these interviews.
Right.
Let's just go from there.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm trying to think about a good way to kind of approach this topic from a fresh perspective. And I keep going back to a beautiful book. I wonder if you've read it. It's 1927 by Ludwig von Mises called Liberalism.
I'm glad you raised it because you mentioned it last time, and I wanted to talk about that again.
So he has this really, and I probably mentioned this last time too, but this last chapter. And it's really interesting. He's looking at ways in which the sort of modern Leviathan state has distorted society and distorted our outlook on life. How society has made us, how Leviathan has sort of created social divisions and made us all annoyed with each other. He actually has a phrase for it. He says that the Leviathan has encouraged warfare sociology. So I'm going somewhere with this. Here's the deal: because there's so much at stake, like sort of in voting outcomes, and there's despotism, you know, lives parasitically off the rest of the social order. We end up sort of turning against each other in a Hunger Games sort of way. Now, what effect does this have on liberalism? Well, Mises answers it this way in the last chapter. He says there's a tendency on the part of public opinion generally, and even within liberalism, to regard itself as a particular party, as a kind of an interest group that favors its interests over somebody else's interests. And he says this is very wrong, and this is a wrong turn for liberalism. In other words, classical liberalism or my more radical libertarianism shouldn't regard itself as a kind of a special interest with particular slate of demands that come at the expense of somebody else's demands. He says that liberalism has no party, it has no songs, no uniforms, sort of list of demands that it wants for itself. That liberalism is the only political outlook that actually seeks the general good of everyone, and seeks the common well-being of all peoples in all places.
Now, surely, though, my lefty friends would say that that's what they're trying to do that, but they're trying to use the state as a tool in so doing, would they not?
Yeah, so this is the problem. They use this is the problem with the left, right? It's not so much that their ideals are wrong, although they often are. What's really wrong about the left is the means that they use to achieve their ideals, and their means are violent. You know, they always have to resort to the state, meaning aggression on people's lives and property. They never really want to talk about this, or recognize it, or even admit it. But if you're going to the state to ask them the state apparatus to achieve your ideals, you're essentially favoring ramping up the use of violence in society, and coercion and regimentation. And who was it that I was just reading this recently? Yeah, some late 19th century classical liberal was talking about the socialists at the time. Not the radical Marxists, but you know, sort of the more civilized socialists of the U.S. and England, that the problem wasn't so much with their ideals, but with the means that, by which they sought to achieve them. I would say this is the core problem with the left more than anything else. There's a tremendous confusion that entered into the left space at some point in the 19th century. I'm not sure entirely when this happened. And it's also, of course, it came full flower in progressive era and the New Deal. But just a kind of a nonchalant willingness to resort to the political machinery in order to sort of make society conform.
Now, we're going into a break in just about, I don't know, 20 seconds. So I want to just throw out this question that we can answer in the next segment. Are we in some way not forced to form ourselves into things like parties, a kind of broad interest group, just by virtue of the fact that those that oppose our approach are so formed and they are so formed in a democracy?
That's a brilliant question, Robin. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. We'll go into the break and we'll discuss that. Back to Blue Republican Radio, and when we went into the break, I was asking Jeffrey the question, even though liberalism, classical liberalism, doesn't seek to operate through a party or to form an interest group that fights against other interest groups, are we not, just as a practical matter, in some way forced to do so, because we operate in a context where such groups do move the political dial, and we need to move the political dial. So there's a kind of tension between the fact, and I actually talk about this when I kind of introduce classical liberalism to some of my student groups. For me, what's compelling about classical liberalism is that it actually isn't a political philosophy. It's almost an apolitical philosophy or a metapolitical philosophy. Mm-hmm. You kind of don't actually have to believe in anything except your immediate experience of liberty, and that can inform your approach to politics in a completely general sense. It doesn't in any way cause you to want to, you know, hold tight to a, you know, an some kind of institutionalized party with a certain name. But here we are, pragmatically. There's obviously some benefits to identifying oneself in political groupings, and operating with the benefits of so doing in a democracy, when it's a democracy that we're trying to influence. So what do you think about that, Jeff?
I think it's inevitable. Of course, it's never going to go away. There are two big problems with political activism. One is that it tends to not be as practical as advertised. Quite often it just doesn't work. I mean, it hasn't really worked for a better part of 100 years. We saw how it worked in like the 18th century and the 19th century to some extent, but it's been a long time since it's really worked well for the liberal cause. There are some exceptions that I could name, maybe the repeal of prohibition, you know, some other issues that have led to a liberalization from the top down through politics, but it's pretty rare. So that's one problem. The other problem I really have with it, and this worries me very much, is it quite often leads to a despair. People get really, really excited about politics and back their man, you know, and throw themselves into it and give money and become sort of passionate about it and almost with a level of religious fervor. And then they find that their man loses, or their man gets elected and betrays them, or something happens to kind of demoralize them. And then they think, well, you know, this whole political thing is just a complete waste of my life. And they go away through despair. And that worries me more than anything. I would say that if you're going to go into politics, that you do so with your eyes wide open to the realities you're confronting, without naivety, really. I think it's actually extremely important, with a real wisdom that you're certainly not going to win the whole thing. You might not win any at all. But and in fact, the most you might be able to hope from political activity is to prevent the system from becoming worse than it is as fast as it might otherwise have. Which is pretty slim pickings as far as victories go.
Okay, but that's not to deny that historically we have seen, going back 1,000 years, a trend in the right direction, let's say in the Anglo tradition.
Yeah.
Right?
The question is, I know. There was a gigantic liberal revolution, right, at some point that sort of swept the world. And, as many books as I've read about this topic, it's still the cause and effect there is unclear. If we could just repeat that experience, it would be a lovely thing. I don't think it's repeatable, though. I think we have to find new and creative ways. To me, the most freeing thing that we can do for the world right now is be creative and innovative from a technological point of view. That doesn't mean reforming the system from the top, but rather sort of building it from within and out, making new institutions. I just reread Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. I think everyone should just reread this every few years if you haven't read it. I mean, it's just absolutely brilliant. But he talks about how the Americans claimed their liberty. It wasn't through revolution. I mean, it wasn't as if there was despotism, then there was a violent revolution, then we got liberty. That wasn't it at all. He talks about the building of liberty all throughout the colonial period, that it sort of already existed very robustly. It was embedded in the culture, embedded in the institutions. It was everywhere, and it was part of the practical reality of people's lives. Then the Declaration of Independence and the subsequent revolution in the United States comes about because of an intolerance towards impositions, So people were sort of claiming and securing what they already believed that they had and that they had a right to. That's a different kind of conception of how liberty is obtained.
Oh, Jeffrey, this is music to my ears. This is what I go around saying to my American friends, because I come from Britain. I kind of come from where the history comes from. I come from where the liberty comes from. And it's really important to understand, I think, that the so-called American revolutionaries, as you've just said, you just explicitly said, they didn't think they were being revolutionaries. In a sense, they were conservative. They were conserving their birthright.
Right.
Was already in the culture. Which goes back to your earlier point, I think. I wanted to say that, you said about political activism can be so very disappointing. But I think because if that's where you, as it were, exert your force, you're exerting your force on the tail rather than the dog. The dog is in the culture and that wags the political tail. The politics always follows what is mainstreamed, normalized in the culture.
That's a very important insight. I mean, that's gigantic. If we think that politics is sort of the first front that we should face, the thing that we should be primarily and even exclusively dedicated to through some sort of ramped up, hysteria, I think we're going to fail.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and I think history shows that quite clearly.
It does, and again, I would go back to Tocqueville here. Mm-hmm. He describes in such detail the way liberty was embedded in institutions and in peoples. It's very interesting. He talks even about, because I guess in his 19th century sort of world, there was an impression that the American Puritans were an intolerant and sort of Talibanish force, as a modern term. But he actually marshals a tremendous amount of evidence from the sermons that you hear, even from the most severe Puritan ministers, that were basically Lockean in their outlook, It was a beautiful thing that the love of liberty was so pervasive that it sort of took many different forms all throughout American society. And there's a beautiful quote he has somewhere in Democracy in America. He says something like, I would completely oppose the imposition of only one form of liberty all over the world.
There you go. Yeah. And that's
should,
what the brutalists...
There should be many, many different expressions of liberty, you know, based on time and culture and people. And I really love that. Now, he's a very interesting guy because he's sort of an aristocratic libertarian in a way. And not an anarchist in any sense, but we have so much to learn from him. Mm. I mean, there's not an imperialistic liberalism about him at all, or an imperialistic libertarianism, or a top-down central plan of we know what's right for society kind of approach.
Yeah.
I mean, he really believes that liberty grows out of the embedded experience and belief structure of a people in a particular time and place. Anyway, I think all of this matters for us now. This is not just a history lesson.
Right.
I mean, it really matters for what we're doing today.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about these ideas, sort of pre-revolution, for example, being pervasive in the culture. We can cause these ideas to become pervasive in an incremental way, such that when tyranny strikes, as it kind of is now in this moment of American history, what is in the culture will inform that reaction. You know, the reaction will make the reaction one from liberty. And I think that is how liberty has stepped up throughout history. Political overreach into the culture, there's something good already in the culture. People sense that something they already have is being taken away by tyranny.
Right.
And then they react.
The culture builds real institutions, real relationships and communities.
We'll talk about that back when we come back from the break. Jeff, we're going into another.
Guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process.
The War State by Michael Swanson is a must-read for anyone interested in the critical 20 years after World War II, when the United States morphed from a constitutional republic to a global imperial superpower. Get The War State by Michael Swanson from Amazon.com today.
So when we went to the break there, Jeffrey, you mentioned, you made the point, a very important point, that culture builds real institutions and communities, things that some, if I can use your word again, brutalist libertarians don't spend any time talking about. And I think that may indeed make us as a group of libertarians appear alien to those who are just living in mainstream culture.
Oh, it's certainly right. I mean, here's the thing. What I described as brutalistic libertarianism is a form of libertarianism, and I don't want to take that away from them. My real hope is to kind of not so much to condemn, but to elevate, and to draw attention that it really is about more than just your rights to do what you want. It's about more than just the freedom to be. To have no social graces, whatever, which I certainly would argue for, it's okay.
Now, do you actually mean that literally, Jeffrey? Do you actually mean that libertarianism is about more than those things? Or do you mean that life is about more than those things?
I think, well, here's the thing. I don't want to get caught up in definitions, what is libertarianism? I mean that liberty and life. I mean, libertarianism is not much good to us unless it can point to a larger, more beautiful result of a flourishing human life under conditions of liberty. And I think we need to kind of broaden our minds and look at that possibility. Well, one reason I think that brutalism exists is because people don't believe that liberty can exist. anymore. I mean, people are despairing as a result of the Leviathan state. You know, but they think, well, look, I'm never going to be able to exercise my rights, really, and we're never going to get a free society. So I might as well just take what I can get right now. You know, and I think that's a kind of an unidealistic way to look at it. You know, and it's inconsistent, I think, with the dreams and the longings of the old liberal tradition, which really sought the best for not just oneself, but for one's community and for the whole world.
So here's a question then that this raises for me: does the liberal tradition itself, or indeed libertarianism as we currently understand it, provide the means, the metrics, the paradigm to actually determine what is the good life, what is more beautiful, what is better? Or do we have to, or is that a completely different project that kind of falls outside, you know, whatever it is that we do as liberals politically, and, you know, small L, classical liberals politically, that we're going to do not because our philosophy necessitates it, but that if we don't, we're just not going to get anybody else to like us. You know, which of those is it?
So I like to go back to Hayek on this. You know, Hayek thought that the most important agenda was to create a space of choice, human volition, and freedom for institutions to sort of develop and develop the tolerance for a wide diversity of those institutions. And that was the essence of the liberal project more than anything else. It wasn't to achieve certain designed and rationalistic ends. It was to create a space and a template, a sort of civilizational template to allow the full multifarious flourishing of the best of human life in every way you can imagine that. He, in Law, Legislation, and Liberty, he actually uses the word the good society, which is an interesting phrase for him to use, because, you know, he's writing, you know, probably at this point 8 to 10 years after Lyndon Johnson, you know, imposed what he called the good society, which is just a bunch of welfare programs, actually, you know.
Yeah.
Hayek sought to take back that term for the liberal cause. I said it's a good society is not something you impose through legislation and transfer programs or redistribution. It's something that emerges out of the decentralized choices of individuals where they are in their time and in their place, doing what's in the best interest of themselves and others in a cooperative way. That's what builds a good society. I just think it's a beautiful image.
Well, definitely. But some pure libertarians would say, though, that our responsibility as libertarians is just to make sure politically that that's allowed, and then, you know, we don't have to care too much about what institutions, you know, what society then does with that freedom. But I think you would say, and correct me again if I'm wrong, that some institutions, you know, some choices with freedom are better than others, make for better lives. Is it important that we as classical liberals or libertarians or even anarchists have anything to say about that, even as a political matter?
I would say that there is a really interesting give and take relationship between freedom and the longing for the higher angels of our nature, and that there's an interrelationship between these two things. Like the larger the state grows, the worse we become as people, and then the worse we become as people, the larger the state grows. So I think the reverse relationship works there too. It's like, if we can get busy building our own forms of freedom that are based in benevolence, cooperation, and creativity and love, we will become less dependent on centralized forms of imposition and Leviathan state control.
Thank you for using the word love. I have been trying to introduce the word love into politics since I started on this. And one of the ways I understand liberty is that it is the political realization of love, because love says as you wish, right? To your loved one, you say as you wish. You want for him or her what he or she wants for him or herself. A liberal politics is one that actually does the same thing politically.
I think that's right. Robin, all beautiful things in the world extend from love. I mean, love is the great creative force. It's the thing that gives birth to new life. It's a creative force in the sense that it takes the existing substance that is around us, merges it and mixes it together, and creates something new, surprising, beautiful, exhilarating.
Yeah.
And it's the reason we wake up. It's the reason we have hope. It's the reason we look forward to tomorrow, so we can discover new wonderful things, all of which extend out of love. Without love, all of history is just data.
Right.
And it's boring.
Right.
And it's not creative. A civilization of love is a prosperous, flourishing place. And
love.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful word. I think I agree that there's a political economy of love.
Yeah. Wow. Now, here's a thought then, which speaks to your, you know, brutalism idea and my purism or orthodoxy idea. I don't think anybody would ever make, or has made, I might be wrong, a serious attempt to systematize what, you know, love, to actually, you know, write it down, what it entails, you know, whatever the axioms of love are and then the consequences, right? Love is necessarily more fluid, more amorphous than that. I can't remember who said it, but I'm reminded of that line, if the soul speaks, then alas, it is not the soul that speaks, right? I mean, it can't be what's ultimate. Right. Ultimate reality can't be spoken. Now, if that's true, if love is the bottom line, then isn't that the denial of all attempts to dogmatize, or even, frankly, at the bottom line, systematize liberty? Define it, even?
Well, I think once you feel like you've understood the whole of it, you probably haven't understood its most important thing.
Right, right.
You know, there's a mystery. Why do we speak of why do we say the word love with such tenderness? You know, why do we always have a sense of awe when we just say that word?
Mm.
And I think the reason is that there's several reasons. One is that it's ultimately mysterious. We really can't take it apart. We can't fully understand it. But there's another reason, too. It's that it's very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
When it appears before us, when we possess it, when we hold it, when we feel it, we should treasure it and guard it and protect it, because it can shatter so quickly. And in so many ways, I would say that the state in the 20th century in particular has sort of shattered our capacity
yes.
to love, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the death, the violence, the impositions, the regimentation, marching around a lockstep, you know, to the dictators and the plan.
And by indeed taking over most of those kind of human transactions, actions
yeah.
that come out of love, right? That we
yeah.
out of love perform for and on each other. The state has taken them over and eliminated our space to actually, you know, realize our love, but, you know, be loving towards each other.
It's true. And Robin, this really gets us back to, I think, the core reason that we wanted to speak. And it has to do with this issue of brutalism versus humanitarianism, as I conceive it.
Mm.
I really think it's extremely important for classical liberals, libertarians, you know, anarcho-capitalists, left libertarians, I don't care what you call us, people who favor the cause of human liberty, to not just hate. Okay, there is a just hate that we have for terrible things in the world, but that doesn't get us all the way. I would like to find yeah. ways for us to fall in love with the idea of human liberty, and for that to be our animating driving force. That's not to say we have a particular agenda that I know the answers. That you know, here's what we should do. But I do think if you're driven by a love for liberty, really, then you start to get creative. Then you can have a benevolent spirit. Then we can have civil discussions. Then we can have lively, robust, lasting institutions that can build the kind of society that we all long for.
And it's I mean, perhaps we can go even one step further. It's not about falling in love with liberty just. It's about using liberty to fall in love with each other, isn't it?
Oh, that's such a lovely way to put it. I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that. But it's, in any case, it's a precondition. You know,
right,
it's something we
right.
shouldn't forget about. You know, we're not just about fists up in the air. You know, it's
yeah.
that's not enough. Sometimes that's necessary, right? And quite often, these days, there's so many horrors in the world, you know. But you can't go to bed every day with hate in your heart. You know, that's just not going to get us from here to there.
Even for the statists.
Even for the state.
For those
you know?
Who would use force.
Yeah. I mean, there should be, it's fine to have a passion for justice, and I think we all feel that. But the question is, what's the next step? You know, what are the ideals that we're seeking? You know, what are we being called to achieve, not just to oppose, but to build? I think it's good for everyone who's liberty-minded to kind of do an examination of conscience in that sense. Like in my case, gosh, Robin, it was a little bit autobiographical, but I fell in love with the idea of innovation and creativity and cooperation and exchange. And just the magic that's associated with the capacity of human beings to get along and work out their problems for themselves. And when this started happening to me, it gave me a really different outlook on life. So that it's very fun now for me to kind of like enter into social spaces and observe what's going on. I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled by so many things that I'm part of. Just the other day, getting off the plane, I kind of watched very carefully at the process of deplaning, how people get out, get their luggage from these luggage racks,
yes.
move in front of each other, defer to those who are disabled, let those who have connecting flights get ahead of them, look down upon those who cut in line. You know, I began to, and it lasted only 10 or 15 minutes, but I'm sitting there in my chair watching this extremely complicated social structure emerge out of this microcosm. And just a matter of minutes. And I found it just magical and marvelous to observe the capacity of human beings to organize themselves imperfectly but beautifully, even in the absence of clear rules, stated rules or statutory rules. You know, the rules emerged out of etiquette and manners, and there was like a court in operation. You know, at the same time, out of a complete diversity of people from everywhere who had never met each other before. And it all happened in the course of minutes, and it took place over 10 or 15 minutes, and then it was over. That, you know, if you can look at a scene like that and say, this is beautiful, this is magic, this is lovely, this is how liberty can work, I think that's a great way to kind of... look at our project. Really, we want a world in which that level of spontaneity and informal organization of humanity takes place with compassion and love and mutual understanding.
Liberty as a means to allow people and to encourage people to express their higher selves, higher selves that, by the way, they can access without having any political ideas at all, just by virtue of their humanity.
That's exactly it, Robin. Don't you think? I mean, I've begun to realize this recently, that we have a sort of slightly exaggerated attachment to this idea that there should be some sort of universal political ideology held by everybody, and which so happens to be ours. I mean, I don't actually believe that, really.
Right, right.
I mean, if we have the right kind of institutions, it shouldn't be necessary to, you know, to quote-unquote convert everyone to every aspect of our belief system.
Yeah, I mean, what we're arguing for here, I think, then, is essentially a very optimistic, and I mean, I would say true, you know, spiritually accurate understanding of what a human being is. I mean, in a way, you know, if you're a Christian, you might say we're made in God's image. I would probably prefer to say we all participate in the divine. We all, you know, we all manifest the divine, whatever way you want to put it. It is a very positive view of humanity that has been borne out by what people do when they are given the kind of liberty we're talking about. And I see now, Jeffrey, we're going into another break, so we'll carry on when we come back.
Thank you.
this has been a very moving hour for me in discussion with Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey, in the interview we did before, the first one we did, you said the purpose of liberty is to serve real people in their real lives. The brutalist paradigm had a very different purpose, if any at all, right?
You know, I didn't understand this when I wrote my first article, but I just assumed that the brutalism was made up like any other theory. You know, like, oh, to hell with beauty, to hell with accoutrements, you know, to hell with loveliness. We're just going, here's your damn building. But that's not actually true. What happened to the School of Architecture grows out immediately of the World War II experience, which was shocking to all the artists and creators in the world. So, you know, you've got the bombing of Dresden, you've got, you know, London being, you know, aerial bombed, you've got Nagasaki, Hiroshima, you've got governments destroying major monuments of civilization all over the world. And so one school of architecture said, you know what, to hell with it. If you think that civilization and beauty is that dispensable, that you just push a button from the air to smash it up to smithereens, we're not going to build it. It's a kind of a protest. Like, here's your damn building. No, it's not beautiful. It's ghastly. It's just purely functional. Destroy it if you want. No great loss. Do you see? I mean, in other words, the brutalist architecture school represented as kind of a nihilism or an absence of hope completely. It was a despairing world view that they adopted, and I think there's the ideological brutalism is in the same sort of camp. You know, it's a tendency to look around the world and say there's no hope, there's no chance for beauty, there's no chance for doing anything good at all. So let's just grab the minimum most that we can and run with it and assert it and shove it down the world's throat. You know, there's an analogy there. I mean, what this story to me about the origin of brutalism does, it makes you slightly, I guess, a little more sympathetic in the sense that, you know, this grows out of world experience. I mean, it grows out of a historical experience that was ghastly. And the brutalist architectural school were, in a way, the victims. You know, they were kind of... you know, this is what emerged.
Jeffrey, this is the end of the show.
Yeah.
We're going to have to carry on in a third, I think.
Yeah, I'd like to see that very much. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you. Hold on a second.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times, WGRR Digital.